It's 7 o'clock here in the NBC newsroom in New York. Time for our staff reporters abroad to give you the latest news from the many war fronts. Tonight we expect reports from Athens, from the Turkish capital of Ankara, from Rome, from Berlin, Cairo, and finally from London. First, our report will come from the Balkans. At this moment, Peter Tompkins, NBC Observer, is checking time with us, so let's go over to Athens.
Hello, NBC. Hello, NBC. This is Peter Tompkins calling from Athens, Greece. The screeching of sirens woke the people of Athens early this morning, and a few people automatically jumped right out of bed. They remembered another time the sirens sounded early one morning. That was on the 28th of October, the day the Italians started their so-called invasion of Greece. And coming at a time like this, sirens at 6 in the morning are liable to give one a bit of a spare. But after looking out at the clear sky and the calmness in the streets, I think most people went back to bed. I know I did. I just stayed on the hotel roof long enough to squint at the sun coming up over the snow-capped hills round Athens. Then I went back to bed, wondering whether anything were really happening. When I finally woke up, I looked out on the square. Everybody was there, drinking coffee just as usual. Children were playing in the park. Evidently, nothing new had happened. But no sooner had I ordered breakfast than the sirens went off again. In a few seconds, the square was empty, except for a few soldiers. People downed the last of their coffees and made for the nearest shelter as quickly as they could. Several children who had been playing with balloons simply let them go. The colored balloons rose gently up into the clear sky. I wondered whether some gay anti-aircraft crew would take a crack at them, but they didn't. In fact, nothing at all happened. And pretty soon, the all-clear sounded. And that is just about as much excitement as we had in Athens today. And reports from the Albanian front indicate that there isn't much action there either. The Italians, in fact, seem to be sitting back, licking their wounds after the failure of Mussolini's famous spring offensive. Details were published in Athens today of the real size of last week's operations. According to freshly captured Italian prisoners, 40 to 50%, and that's almost half, of the 120,000 men Mussolini threw into these desperate attacks are now out of action. And that's an awful lot of men to lose for one offensive, which has so far been about as successful as Mussolini's original plan for invading Greece. Since these attacks failed, the Italians are said to be devoting most of their energy now to collecting the dead and the wounded. For the last few days, they have only made a few half-hearted attacks with reduced forces. The Greeks are reported to have repelled these easily with artillery fire. A few Italian night attacks, which were supposed to surprise the Greeks, have again turned out to be surprises for the Italians. As usual, the Italians landed on wide-awake Greek machine gun nests. Even tonight's Greek communique, which has just been issued, reports nothing but slight artillery action. And that, I'm afraid, is just about all the news I can give you from Greece tonight. This is Peter Tompkins speaking from Athens, Greece.
We've returned to the NBC newsroom in New York before making our next overseas hop. On our schedule, as originally planned, we'd hoped to bring you a broadcast from Ankara, Turkey. But the transmitter in Ankara is not on the air. We've been monitoring their wavelength, and so we'll have to defer, if not cancel, that broadcast tonight from Ankara. Meanwhile, here in the newsroom in New York, let's listen to Borkage one of our Washington observers who is here with us tonight. Borkage.
Borkage talking. Today, President Roosevelt, with his desk pretty well cleared up, looked forward to a few days under the southern sun, probably on the high seas. You know, he told us at his last White House press conference last Friday that he still had a little cold in his nose. He had nothing scheduled between the opening of the new Mellon Art Gallery tomorrow and the Jackson Day dinner on the 29th of this month, and he'd like to have some sunlight. The president's had two major problems before him, the solution of which awaited the passage of the Lend-Lease Bill. One was the need of waking the nation to what he felt was a realization of the seriousness of the defense situation. And second, and really in part depending on the first, the need of a plan to end delays in the defense program due to strikes. He made his appeal to the nation last night for renewed effort in the defense program. In that speech of his delivered at the annual banquet of the White House Correspondents' Association. He's now about ready to issue an executive order creating a labor mediation board to deal with disputes in the defense industry. Today he talked with Philip Murray, head of the CIO, and after the talk, the indications were that if the president really wanted to create this board as he does, the CIO would not press those objections which they had previously brought forward. You know, one of the most loudly applauded passages in the president's speech last night at the banquet was the warning that strike delays must cease. Watching those listeners at the head table as the president spoke last night was almost as impressive as the president's dramatic delivery. I remember Vice President Wallace. He didn't take his eyes off the speaker. He sat there a couple of places to the president's left, turned sideways in his chair with his hand to his forehead and his face tense. And three or four places on the other side, to the right of the president, was Harry Hopkins, his elbows on the table and his clenched hands to his face most of the time. Today, one of the effects of the speech was noticeable in Washington. Support increased for the rapid approval of the $7 billion request to implement this aid to democracy's law. Senator Nye, who opposes that, who'd like to cut the bill right in two, that is, the amount of money in two, called the president's speech last night a good pep talk for Britain and certain other countries, but said that America seemed to be the forgotten nation in the picture. However, it's predicted that the appropriation will go through rapidly. Just as the president's personal plans have been affected by the passage of the measure, so Senator Burns' immediate future is now being kept in suspense. It's pretty generally believed that the South Carolina senator will be appointed to the Supreme Bench. You know, he's a member of the Senate Appropriations Committee, too. And it isn't likely that he'll be removed from that job until the $7 billion appropriation has been voted on. There was one piece of news from the State Department today that will interest newspaper people and others, too. The embassy in Berlin cabled that the American correspondent, Richard Hotelet, who was arrested by the Nazis, is still being held incommunicado. The German police told a member of the American embassy staff in Berlin that Hotelet could not be interviewed until after the secret police had made their inquiry. Then they said he could talk with American diplomatic representatives and could also get his legal counsel. It was promised that the case would be given prompt attention. There is no official explanation of the arrest, although unofficially it was said it was connected with spy espionage charges. But it will be remembered that the grand jury here in New York recently indicted the German head of the Transocean News Service for failing to register as an alien propaganda agent. And this German step against Hotelet might be retaliation. Speaking of the German government, although they don't know it yet, the Nazis have had to contribute financially to the American defense program. Last night, Kurt Sell, the Washington correspondent of the German official news service, after he had finished telephoning a translated summary of the president's speech to Berlin, he asked for the charges. They seemed pretty high to him, although he knew his text had run about five pages. He was politely informed by the transatlantic telephone operator that the charge of $124 included the defense tax. That's all, and thanks very much.
That was Borkage, NBC observer in Washington who is with us here in Radio City tonight. We've just received a bulletin from Washington. The Navy Department has just announced that 6 vessels of the United States fleet are at Auckland, New Zealand, for a 3-day visit. Continuing our coverage of the European capitals, we have a report from Italy. Go ahead, Rome.
Hello, NBC. This is David Anderson speaking from Italy. While President Roosevelt spoke to America last night, the Italian people were sleeping. The difference in time between the old and new worlds explains why there are no press comments on the speech in Italian newspapers today. Rome Radio tonight said that the speech was merely designed to arouse the spirits of the American masses. But there are also certain generalities which can be made in the light of the president's words. For several weeks now, the main subject of most Italian newspapers has been bellicose America. The attempt, apparently, has been to show the Italian people that America is on its way toward war with the Axis, a war which, they say, the American people as a whole do not want, and for which they are little prepared. So they pin the responsibility for this bellicose spirit onto the shoulders of President Roosevelt, the Jews, and the big industrialists. Opposition speeches to the lease and lend bill, anti-intervention groups in the United States, and recent strikes in war production plants are pointed out here as signs that the American people want to remain out of the conflict. Well, bellicose or not, the fact remains that the lease and lend bill has passed, and America's entered into a new phase in her aid to Britain. But a challenge has been raised for the Italian press. It is one thing to say that America will aid Great Britain, but can she deliver the goods? Through a series of articles, the Italian newspapers have tried to show that the German sea force dominates the Atlantic. British shipping is fast being sent to the bottom of the sea, and spring is coming. Spring, of course, is just another word for the long-promised submarine warfare. So as far as I have been able to judge the recent Italian press and radio reports, American aid to Britain is minimized. And yet, it is obvious that these countries are concerned. How they will answer the president's words when he said, quote, Britain will get these war materials, unquote, is unknown. Tomorrow, we'll probably know more. Meanwhile, the important Florence newspaper La Nazione last week advocated treating Americans in Italy as enemies and spies. Restaurant waiters and shopkeepers were told to show as little courtesy as possible and certainly not to speak more than necessary when serving an American. From my own experiences here in Italy up to a short time ago, I have found very little antipathy toward the fact that I am an American. Only on one occasion, a couple of months ago, did I find any sign of anti-Americanism. I was speaking German with a couple of Italians in a train coming from Florence to Rome. When I mentioned that I was an American, one of them refused to speak to me. More recently, however, on more than one occasion, I thank my 2 years of college German for saving a situation. English is fast becoming an unpopular language here. Restaurant waiters who once used to practice their few words of English are now reluctant to say as much as good evening. German is becoming a stock language even for street vendors of curios and picture postcards. Here in the Paro Romano yesterday, I was accosted by several of these salesmen speaking a poor but intelligible German. Yugoslavia's alignment with the Axis powers within the week is accepted as a foregone conclusion among well-informed circles here in Rome. The only question seems to be, will she only sign a non-aggression and friendship pact with Germany, or will she become a member of the tripartite pact? Yugoslavia has already signed a non-aggression pact with Italy. If she signs a tripartite pact, this may be an indication that German troops want to cross the Yugoslav-Albanian frontier for an offensive against the Greeks. And speaking of the Greeks, there are only the most meager reports to substantiate the claims that the Italians are entering the 7th day of the Greek offensive. So far, about the only reference made to this offensive is that the Italian Air Force has stepped up its bomb raid. La Voce d'Italia today graphically indicates 37 places on the Greek map which have been bombed during the last week. This offensive, if it exists, and if it is the real Italian effort to push the Greeks back, is very significant. The outcome of this offensive may determine the when and how of a German move in this direction. This is David Anderson returning you to NBC in New York.
Anderson reporting from Rome, and now a report from the northern end of the Rome-Berlin axis. Go ahead, Berlin.
Hello, NBC. This is Charles Lanius in Berlin. Adolf Hitler told the German people today that the strength of the German armed forces is invulnerable, and that no power on earth can alter the final outcome which he predicted for this war. The leader of 85 million Germans made this statement in an annual memorial service to honor German war dead. His speech was broadcast from the Armory Hall at the War Museum on Unter den Linden, just a short distance from the memorial dedicated to Germany's unknown soldiers. Hitler laid the blame for this war at the door of the powers who drafted the Versailles Treaty and said that the German people had been forced into it. But he said, never in the history of Germany has her armed forces been mightier than they are now. And there, according to Hitler, lies the mistake of those powers who drew up the Versailles Dictate. They didn't take into account the strength and determination of the leaders of New Germany. Today, he declared, the German army is ready, with vastly increased manpower and material, to finish in 1941 what was begun in 1940, the destruction of England. He assured the people that a German victory was a certainty. The army, he said, was ready, cool and determined. Then Hitler went on to praise the Italians fighting in the South. Our Italian comrades, he said, have, during the early part of this year, borne the brunt of the battle, but now Germany is going to take her share. The 13-minute speech went off with the usual National Socialist splendor. Later today, Hitler signed a decree providing for special memorial cemeteries in various parts of Germany to be used only for the German soldiers killed in the present war. These new graveyards will be built by the best architects, sculptors, and designers to be found in Germany. Military news tonight hit a new low for this week, but a report which came in a short while ago tells us that for the second time in 24 hours, German Stukas dived out of the sky above Malta to attack military objectives there. That was this morning, and the Germans claim they downed a British Hurricane which tried to intercept their attack. The High Command today says that in the first attack, German air marksmen sent a British Vickers Welling plunging to the ground after a brief air battle. A German Stuka squadron leader, Captain Peter Hinkeldein, here in Berlin on leave, explained to me how this Mediterranean trick is done. That is, he explained in part. Usually, he said, anywhere from 60 to 70 Stukas and protecting planes are used when the Germans go after Malta. Naturally, they fly high, with part of the fires above the Stukas and others at a lower level. When they're ready to unload their bombs, the Stuka pilots sometimes must dive several thousand feet. Some of the fighters go down, too, so as not to be surprised by British fighters suddenly coming out of the clouds to do a little swooping themselves. According to Captain Hinkeldein, this simple system works well. Another report tonight is that a 5,000-ton British merchant ship has been disabled by a German flying fortress about 210 miles west of Northern Ireland. The Germans say it's a total loss. Today's German communique claims that during the last 3 days, 31 British planes have been destroyed. During the same period, the Germans admit losing 21 of their own planes. Now, if there's any time in the year that most Germans like a little holiday, it's around Easter. But this year, it looks like most of them will be out of luck. Today, it's publicly requested that Germans refrain from using the railways from April 10th through April 16th. And if any citizen thinks he can get around this by simply going to the railroad station and buying a ticket to wherever he wants to spend Easter vacation, he'll soon discover that the German authorities have thought of that one, too. In order to board a train going anywhere, a special permit must be obtained. And these permits are to be issued only in limited numbers. And should any holiday seeker reach his destination in one way or another, he'll find that a special permit is needed to get back home. The authorities announce they are sorry the situation must be handled in this matter, but the railway lines are already overburdened with transportation of vitally important freight needed to carry out the war program. And since automobile travel is practically out of the question, it seems that the average German will have to stay home this year, or if he's determined enough, ride a bicycle. Another new law operating affects music lovers. The commissioner for prices decreed that new phonograph records can't be bought unless the buyer has an old record he is willing to turn in on exchange. This is Charles Lanius in Berlin,
I now return you to NBC in New York.
Now to the British side of the conflict. First, the news in Egypt. Go ahead, Cairo.
This is Grant Parr speaking from Cairo, Egypt. Despite the apparent complexity of Britain's efforts in East Africa, there are today only two main objectives. One is the Karen Asmara area in Eritrea. The other is Addis Ababa. Karen is merely a siege problem. Addis Ababa, from the British point of view, is a problem in military tactics. From the Italian point of view, it is a problem in morale. Some 44 years ago, when Emperor Menelik, great king of the Ethiopians, was on his way to meet the Italian invaders of that day, he camped in a pleasant township nestled cozily among the Entoto Hills. Noticing the natural advantages, the fine climate, the abundance of trees and water, Menelik vowed that if he defeated the Italians, he would make the place his capital. After his victory at Adawa, he kept his promise. Thus, the very foundations of Addis Ababa have an anti-Italian tradition. The town itself is so basically Ethiopian that even the 5 years of Italian effort have not made it otherwise. It possesses signs of civilization, a few stone buildings with metal roofs built originally by Greek or Armenian tradesmen, the mushroom growth of corrugated metal huts which the Italians have erected. Yet, Addis Ababa had vigorous roots that the Italians have found harder to erase than traditions of older towns. For Addis Ababa, crude and incongruous as it is, was the showplace of the Ethiopian king, just as truly as Cyrenaica was Mussolini's Exhibit A. Menelik built Addis, and his successors carried on there. Once a wood shortage made it appear that the capital would have to be transferred, as it had been many times in the past. Menelik had quick-growing eucalyptus or blue gum trees planted and averted that danger. Haile Selassie fought for Addis Ababa, and many of his followers died for it. Small wonder that the Italians never felt at home there. Even in the days of peace, they walked uneasily through the bustling market section, crowded with merchandise, vendors, customers, and mules. Despite the Italians, it remains a typically Ethiopian market. Natives ride in on muleback. Their wives and sometimes other mules carry their produce, handwork, fuel, and fertilizer. The latter two are often the same. Into Addis Ababa today are crowded upwards of 30,000 Italian soldiers, besides most of the surviving colonists and their families, men and women who tried to build a new Italy in the wilderness. Even the corrugated metal houses are filled to capacity. They are bake ovens by day and refrigerators more than air cooled by night. The soldiers must use tents. The civilians often are less fortunate. In some cases, natives have been pushed out of their mud-walled, thatched-roof dwellings. For there was a housing shortage in Addis even before the war. Daily, small bands of beaten, discouraged soldiers, many of them wounded, trickle into the town to add to the congestion and discouragement. But many of the natives are slipping away into the hills. They don't go far, only far enough to join raiding and sniping bands that are operating almost at the very outskirts of the capital. It was hell, reported deserters from the Italian column retreating toward Addis from Burai in the rebel-ridden Gojam. It must be much the same in Addis itself, for the vital food and supplies that used to fetch high prices in the pre-war days are rapidly disappearing, even in Massawa and Djibouti. Patriot raiders make roads and railways nearly impassable. The spikes in copper telegraph wire from the railway right-of-way have an odd habit of disappearing. The metal is ideal for Ethiopian spear points. At least six British columns now operating in Ethiopia might, if unchecked, reach Addis Ababa. Two are immediate threats. One is the British-directed Patriot force moving south from Debra Marco with 120 miles to go. The other is the South and West African column now approaching Jijiga and Harar, and with them access to the Djibouti Railway. If the railway is cut and Patriots sever the vital road to the north, Addis Ababa will be in a state approaching siege. The Italians might make the Anglo-Ethiopian forces attempt an assault, but it is known that the Italians are war-weary and extremely nervous. This is Grant Parr returning you to the NBC.
Grant Parr, NBC reporter in Cairo. Finally, a report from our London office. Go ahead, John McVane.
This is London. One raid alarm has sounded in London tonight. Many incendiaries and some high explosive bombs fell in a west of England town, but blazes are said to have been put out immediately. Some bombs dropped near an east Scottish town, but did no damage. Most of Britain heard the London air raid siren tonight. The British Broadcasting Company's 9 o'clock.
Seems to be an interruption, we hope temporary, in our signal from John McVane speaking from London. Meanwhile, we'd like to bring you from the NBC newsroom a bulletin from Vichy. Fritz Thyssen, wealthy German steel manufacturer who early in the Nazi movement gave financial support to Adolf Hitler, is now a prisoner in the notorious Nazi concentration camp at Dachau, it was disclosed today. Thyssen, who fled Germany after a disagreement with Hitler, was arrested by French authorities in unoccupied France, where he was living at Côte d'Azur, and handed over to the German military authorities. This was in accordance with the Franco-German armistice terms, a Vichy government spokesman explained. Thyssen's arrest several weeks ago was at first officially denied and was admitted only recently. The news is still being withheld from the French press. For several weeks, the National Broadcasting Company is informed Thyssen had been trying unsuccessfully to leave France and to proceed to Argentina. Now our signal has been corrected, and we go once again overseas to London.
There has been no official comment yet in London on President Roosevelt's speech. Unofficially, informed quarters are making no attempt to hide their jubilation. As for the ordinary people, there is no doubt that they consider it the most heartening statement that has come to them across the Atlantic. Extracts from the speech were rebroadcast in Britain this morning, and the full speech was rebroadcast early this afternoon. News bulletins have carried full reports. A BBC news broadcast tonight said listeners in Britain were impressed with the way in which the American and British peoples were so closely linked in the struggle for freedom. The British broadcaster said, quote, "The speech's confidence, determination, idealism, and enthusiasm, and the warm applause with which it was greeted, provided an unforgettable experience," end of quote. The press will have the first real chance to comment on it tomorrow morning, and editorial writers are sure to draw attention to the vigor of the president's message. To some observers here, the speech seemed to mark the change in America's status from a benevolent well-wisher to an outright ally. And there is no doubt in the mind of anyone I've talked with today, from serving girls to soldiers and diplomats, that at last Britain can count on America to gear up her industrial output of war supplies to a speed that is usually possible only to a democracy at war, or to a totalitarian nation preparing for war. British industry wasn't called on to make a supreme effort until Mr. Churchill became Prime Minister and the Battle of France had begun. From their own mistakes and the mistakes of France, the masses of the British people learned a lesson. After last night's speech, they feel that they aren't the only ones to realize what must be done if democracy is to win its battle. This afternoon, the British learned from their Minister of Labor, Mr. Bevan, how the government intends to mobilize manpower and woman power to get still more speed out of industry. The government's plan is aimed at bringing into the war industrial machine hundreds of thousands of people who still aren't contributing directly to the war effort. Women are to be drafted into industry. Women of 20 and 21 are to be registered. The 20s on April 19th. They will be interviewed, given a list of jobs of national importance, and allowed a few days to decide what they want to do. First chance will be given to those displaced from work in non-essential trades and to young women now out of work. Women and small children with special home responsibilities will be exempted. New regulations are being made to draw a greater number of women into industry. There are many married women now holding down jobs, Mr. Bevan said, whom the government wants to transfer to war work. Local authorities are to provide people to mind the children of mothers while they are at work. This is John McVane in London, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
And that's the news on the war fronts as the 562nd day of conflict gets underway. Tonight you've heard from reporters in Athens, Rome, Berlin, Cairo, London, and Borkage in New York. This is Ben Grauer speaking in this presentation of the Blue Network of the National Broadcasting Company.